but hopefully she'll be able to join us soon. I just like to point out that we're gathered here today in Treaty One territory, which is the traditional territory of the Cree, the Oji-Cree, the Anishinaabe, the Dene. Sorry, I just lost track here. The Cree, the Oji-Cree, the Anishinaabe, the Dene, and Dakota peoples, as well as the homeland of the Métis Nation. Wenisketan also works with communities in Treaties 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. This webinar is the second in a series that Wenisketan is putting on over the summer. And you might have caught our first one, which was a conversation on land-based education. That was 2 weeks ago. The webinars are going to be about every 2 weeks, so our next one will be coming out 2 weeks from now, so you can watch out for that one. Wenisketan is a research alliance between U of M researchers and Indigenous communities that have been impacted by hydro. And this is also put on by Kitatipithitamak Mithwewin, which is a new project from Wenisketan that is looking at how COVID is impacting Indigenous communities. So my name is Hannah. I'm the project coordinator for that COVID Indigenous project, and I'll be monitoring here today. Let's see. We wanted to do this one, our second one in this series on Indigenous food sovereignty. It was one of the first topics that came up when we were discussing which topics we wanted to cover with this series, obviously because food is so important when we're thinking about how we relate to the land, when we're thinking about questions of Indigenous sovereignty and self-determination. Wenisketan, as I mentioned, works with a lot of hydro-impacted communities, and food is central to that in terms of how hydro and flooding has impacted fishing livelihoods and traditional hunting territories and berry picking territories. And then when we're thinking about the context of COVID today, there's stories coming out about how COVID has impacted Indigenous food sovereignty and Indigenous food systems. And sometimes there are positive stories, like from OPCN, where Asfia does her work that maybe we'll be hearing about later, where people are responding to the challenges to the food system and the disruptions to food supply chains by returning to the land and by returning to some of those ways of self-provisioning. So how it's going to work today is, oh, and it looks like Priscilla is joining us. Great. Hi, Priscilla. We're just doing introductions here, but we haven't quite started yet. So I was just going to go quickly over how things will work today. Well, I'll let each of the panelists introduce themselves, then talk a little bit more in depth about their work on Indigenous food sovereignty. And then we'll talk a little bit about how COVID is impacting Indigenous food sovereignty and how they're responding to it with their work. So it'll take us to about 5:30. And as I mentioned before, if you have any questions for those of you who are watching either on Zoom or on Facebook Live, you can drop those in the chat. And we have people monitoring them, and they'll be able to collect those questions. And hopefully at the end, we'll have time to pose at least a few of them to our panelists. So I think that's everything. I think we're ready to get started here. Again, welcome to our panelists, Don Morrison, Tabitha Martins, Asfia Kamal, and Priscilla Setti. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today. So I'd like to maybe invite Don to speak first. Don, you're joining us today from so-called BC, and you're the founder and director of the Working Group on Indigenous Food Sovereignty. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about yourself and your work, please?
Okay, yes, thank you for opening up the time and space for this webinar. And so yes, my name is Dawn Morrison. As the founder and curator of the Working Group on Indigenous Food Sovereignty, I've been working for the last 15 years, showing up consistently to organize time and space for literally thousands of Indigenous peoples who Priscilla and Tabitha are definitely two of the movers and shakers who've showed up to share analysis and insight into the realities of the Indigenous peoples and the ways that we express food sovereignty in our hunting, fishing, farming, and gathering beyond the colonial agri-centric narrative. And I'm a member of the Shikwetmuk Nation, and while I'm really grateful to learn about your work working with Cree people and Dene and Dakota, as I heard you introduce, people like Priscilla and Tabitha have taught me about, you know, during the time that I've spent, the little time I've spent in Cree territory, and just some of the books I've read by James Dashuk about clearing the plains and the history that Cree people share with my people, the Shikwetmuk, and in around across Canada, the Indigenous people I've talked with about the injustices, the systemic injustices, and the ways they're playing out now, and COVID is real. And so I'll speak to that after, but we have three main components of our work right now with the Working Group on Indigenous Food Sovereignty. And one of them, a big part of it, that people like Tabitha and Priscilla and others who have helped us to kind of shape and form the narrative and to decolonize the land and food system. And so we've developed a cross-cultural interface framework that we use as a tool to create safe spaces for Indigenous peoples that often carry the burden of the cross-cultural learning tension when we talk about decolonizing land and food systems. So we've developed tools and terminology, and we're putting that to test in a lot of the work we do with different researchers and institutions and government agencies and networks, even within our own communities sometimes, because the oppression and the systemic injustices plays out within our own communities sometimes as well, laterally. So that's an important part of our work. And we have a team of about 15 people. We're also a part of a bigger network, the Indigenous Circle that Priscilla and Tabitha and I worked on in our relationship to Food Secure Canada. So a more kind of pan-Canadian approach. And then the second component of our work is the Wild Salmon Caravan, and it's a celebration of the spirit of wild salmon, a way to use the arts and the culture as a way of engaging the public on issues around our most important Indigenous food and keystone species in so-called BC, and the threats to it and the ways that Indigenous knowledge plays such an important role in wild salmon, when the conservation of wild salmon in their habitat. So stay tuned for more on that. We have a website, wildsalmoncaravan.ca. And then the third component is the most recent project that we're just starting into the second year of. We've got 3 years to develop it, and it's the Indigenous Food and Freedom School. And we're developing a toolkit to share with Indigenous communities all over. And we're aiming to have that by September, although we may need to push that back a little bit because of COVID. But basically it's an emancipatory learning model within a learning circle of experts that have come to our cohorts. And so it's to develop, test, and evaluate tools that can support Indigenous peoples and leaders to increase our capacity to scale out this movement. And that's all I'll say for now for my introduction.
Thanks so much, Dawn. Yeah, I think that aspect that you mentioned last of like these toolkits to scale up the work that you're doing on Indigenous sovereignty is really exciting. And so hopefully, I know that those resources are still being developed, but we can link to some of those if people are interested in learning more. Thank you.
Can I just say one more thing? I'm sorry. I'll make it quick. The part of the decolonizing the food system that Priscilla and Tabitha have also been involved with is to dismantle structural racism in the food system. So again, the tools that we've developed is to try and create some cultural safety in that work, because we know that as Indigenous peoples, all of the land policies, water, food, is very much centered on a colonial narrative, not ours. So it's really systemic, it's structural, and we've been mobilizing coalitions and developing community agreements to that effect with different groups.
Thanks, really important point. Next, maybe we'll go to Priscilla. Priscilla's joining us from Saskatchewan today, where she's a prof at the University of Saskatchewan. She's also an adjunct prof here at the U of M at the Natural Resources Institute that some of you might be familiar with. She's originally from Cumberland House Swampy Cree First Nation, and she just released a co-edited book called Indigenous Food Systems, Concepts, Cases, and Conversations. Priscilla, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself? Oh, Tabitha's holding it up. I don't know if you guys can see her.
Because almost everyone has a chapter in it, so it's amazing, wonderful. And I'm actually just starting, I'm in the midst of my coursework for spring term, and I'm using it, and the students are loving it. Of course, teaching remotely has really is a different pedagogy than having students actually get their fingers dirty and soil, work the soil. So anyway, but yeah, it's been really exciting to use that new book. But to back up a little bit, you know, this is kind of lifelong work that I've been involved in since the 70s, working with communities, mostly Northern Cree communities, some Dene, to really address what is vital, but also what's under attack in terms of the things that Dawn talked about. And so currently I'm working with, as a David Suzuki Fellow, to really document the impact of Western development on people's trapping, hunting, and gathering activities. But also a part of that is not just to talk about the desecration of the land, which is important, but more importantly to highlight the forms of knowledge that are really important in a cultural context as a very essence of community. And you know, the fact that, you know, that our province insists on clear cutting every last piece of timber, every last, you know, tree in the community is really not good, and has, of course, having a really strong impact, devastating impact on our communities. So there's always, you know, in addition to having one foot planting, there's always this other one that is always responding to the state. So I just gave a webinar last week on this international human rights conference. And in it, I described how, you know, the scholars and people in positions of power, and of course, people on the land, but it's really important for that level of authority, if you want to call it that, to impress on the decision makers the need for a really life enforcing policy structure, which Canada does not have. We've got outstanding land claims. We've got land grabs where foreign interests are coming in using people's, you know, pension funds to just obliterate, you know, purchase up the land, and then of course do this mega corporate industrial agriculture programs. In the meantime, here we are in Saskatchewan with, you know, like so many dozens of unsettled land claims. So in the specter of this globalization pandemic, we are really on the boots on the ground to make government, where, you know, corporations listen to us. And it's not working. I mean, I think Dawn and Tabitha and other folks on listening know that the, you know, the neoliberal policies, which Dawn writes about succinctly in her chapter in our book, really, you know, the prime minister plays nice with us, like he puts on a good face, but in the meantime, signing all these international trade agreements that really wipe out Indigenous nations. So one of the things in my policy brief that I wrote for Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations 2 years ago was, you know, what are our official leadership in terms of First Nations, what are they saying about these international trade agreements? Do they really understand the depth of it? And how are they prepared to go to bat for communities to fight for, you know, human rights that are being abrogated under these free trade agreements? And, you know, that's the whole business of globalization that is really, really impacting small farmers and women throughout the globe who are the most productive food producers, but it's these, you know, the corporate interests that are really just running roughshod over our lands and our culture and our ability to live in peace and harmony. So this was the thing that Dawn and I and Tabitha really reinforced to what they call the kind of the mainstream food sovereignty movement, to realize that, you know, how deeply we are under attack in terms of cultural rights and knowledge, and how the great impact that Western development has had since, you know, the time that James Dashchuk was writing, currently right through to today. So I'll just summarize finally that, you know, in my job as academic, I work within a university that has a very powerful Department of Agriculture. And, you know, students thankfully are coming to this class, the class I teach, and saying, you know, the policies of the corporate sector in agriculture does not reflect my needs as a student. Not everyone, of course, but many of them. And we really want to learn about, you know, the stories of food sovereignty, the struggle for it, because we see what's happening, you know, under the COVID pandemic. You know, food has become a central feature of this. So we are gaining allies. I'm very happy and proud when I meet people like you, Hannah, who are really using your influence to help us push, you know, this important struggle for land, liberty, life, and Indigenous rights. So there'll be more time to talk about some of the COVID response. So I think that's it for me.
Thanks so much, Priscilla, for giving that really great, like, big picture overview. And I think that there are some really interesting points there about, like, the intersection in between Indigenous food sovereignty and then just, like, the overall food system and small-scale farmers, and how everyone in some ways is suffering from some of the same problems of large-scale ag and globalization, although then there are also important differences, and maybe that's something that we can talk about a little bit later. But thanks very much, and thanks for joining us. Next, we'll go to Tabitha Martins, and Tabitha is joining us from here in Winnipeg. She's a Swampy Cree educator, writer, and a PhD candidate as well. And as we've already talked about, she's also worked closely with Dawn and Priscilla as well. So Tabitha, over to you.
Hi, so Tanse, Sipagobanisis, Nichisnakasun. My name is Tabitha. I'm Deer Clan. My family, the Cree part of my family is historically from Norway House. Although I spend more of my time with my family in Fisher River. So if you know anything about the history of Norway House, you know that there was, Fisher River used to be up where Norway House is, and now that's why we have one Cree community floating in the south. So I come to this work in really, I suppose, I come to this work for really personal reasons and in really personal ways. Largely to explore, I think, some of the trauma in my family's own history, and discovering that how healing land could be, and how healing it could be to reconnect to my traditional food system. So that's a bit how I came to this work. And in particular, my interest lies around, like, Winnipeg. My Cree ancestors and my Icelandic ancestors met fishing the waters of Lake Winnipeg. And so I very much consider Lake Winnipeg to be my home territory. And I consider those waters to hold my ancestry. I am also a PhD candidate, which I talk about a lot less. But I'm probably the most proud of the activist-based work that I do. And so some of that, Priscilla and Dawn have already spoken about, but some of that in particular is around racism in the food systems. So I talk a lot and am pushing back against the Safe Food for Canadians Act, which is a policy that prevents our people from being able to share traditional foods. And also things like racism in the food system as it pertains to women and land camps. Women and man camps, I'm sorry. So the man camps that are often the result of hydro impacts and what that means for our food systems as another example of the kind of racism that occurs within communities. So that's certainly one of the areas of my work, but I'm in the faculty of social, I'm doing my PhD in the Faculty of Social Work. My background is in science, but I moved into social work largely because I wanted to explore and demonstrate the interdisciplinary nature of food. And also because our people are overly represented in child welfare and social services. And I just found it, I found there to be an incredible gap in terms of the ways that we approach Indigenous helping and healing within social work. In regards to the fact that we tend not to use land, or certainly social work practice tends not to use land, which I think is a major challenge. So that is just a little sampling of some of the work that I do, but I can talk more about some of the COVID stuff a little bit later. So Egose, thanks.
Thanks, Tabitha, and thanks for joining us. And then last but not least, we'll have Asphia introduce herself. Asphia is a postdoc at the Aboriginal Research Center, and she's actually working with Dr. Alex Wilson at the University of Saskatchewan. And those of you who saw our first webinar 2 weeks ago would have seen Alex speak on land-based education. It was a great session. So she's Asphia is working with Alex. And she's also working with OPCN and has worked with them for the past 11 years on a community-based Indigenous food sovereignty program. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that and about yourself, please, Asphia.
Thank you so much. First of all, I would like to acknowledge that it's a great honor to be part of this discussion today where Tabitha, Dawn Morrison, and Dr. Siti is taking part. I have great admiration and respect for your work. I read your work, and thank you so much for your amazing leadership and much important work that we all need at the current moment. About myself, I would like to define my work as a collective initiative. I have been working with Opi Ponapiu and Cree Nation, in short, OPCN, and also known as South Indian Lake, for the past 11 years, initially for my PhD and now for my postdoc. An amazing group of people who have been fighting the flooding created by Manitoba Hydro in the early 70s. And without much help, they have been surviving, struggling, and fighting back. And have been teaching me a lot. I would say my work is more like interactive knowledge sharing process, and it's been, I would echo with a little bit with Tabitha, that it's been personally really important for me, because it is a healing process for me, seeing these kinds of injustice happening in Canada. I'm a non-Indigenous person. I must acknowledge that I was not aware of these kinds of really intensive injustice happening, discrimination happening in Canada. So it was a shock for me initially when I came here and I saw people without running water, just 12 hours of difference from Winnipeg, how this could be happening. And still now, situation hasn't changed much. So I admire the strength of the community members that I work with. And from the very beginning, I have been mentored by the elders of Opiponapian Cree Nation. I would like to acknowledge Elder Annie Spence, Elder Hilda Dysert, Elder Vivian Moose, some of the key elders and leaders in the community, and also Eating to Mitsuin program, a food from the land program that we have started in the community as part of the PhD project. I was part of their team, and I was in the community working with the community champions and the elders to make this project happen. Bringing the youth and the elders together for traditional harvesting activities, hunting, fishing, creating some activities to knowledge archiving, and also trying to apply for funding so we can create employment opportunity in the community. So these are some of the key things that we have been doing for the past 11 years. More recently, I have started working with Dr. Alex Wilson, an amazing mentor. She and I are working on a project that's also focusing on food sovereignty and health sovereignty. So creating health educational material that will be useful for the community youth. So here also, with the leadership of the community elders and their mentorship, we are trying to do as much as possible to archive traditional knowledge, some useful information, you know, information regarding to medicinal properties, information regarding to the use of traditional food, harvesting techniques, and much more. So this is just a little bit what I'm doing. We have an amazing partner who have been helping us. So I'd like to also acknowledge Northern Manitoba Food Culture and Community Collaborative. I'm pretty sure many of you know this program is working with a number of First Nation communities throughout Northern Manitoba, all the community-based programs they're supporting. And for Eating to Mitsuin program in Opiponapian Cree Nation, they are very, very grateful to this organization for the funding and other support. So yeah, I guess this is just a little bit of introduction from my side. And I will look forward to talk to you more about some details in the next segment. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Asfia, and thanks for joining us. The next thing we'll deal with is just a little bit quick definition of just what Indigenous food sovereignty is and what it means to each of you. Probably, or perhaps maybe most of people in the audience, because you're joining this webinar, have some idea of what this concept is and what it means. But I think it would be really interesting to hear from each of you. What does Indigenous food sovereignty mean? So we'll start with Dawn.
Okay, thank you. So basically, I'll just sum it up. I'm going to just show a picture because I forgot to show it. But I'll, just while I'm speaking, if you don't mind. Okay. So this picture here is, it's just representative of all the different people that have come to help me understand what Indigenous food sovereignty is. It just speaks to the number of people, and that's why I wanted to show it. I don't quite know how to get rid of the column on the side, so I'll just leave it because I don't want to waste time unless somebody can quickly tell me how. I'm still learning out all this tech stuff, but if it's okay, I can just leave it too. But over the last, I mentioned earlier, 15 years of since I became the founder and the curator of the Working Group on Indigenous Food Sovereignty, I've convened a lot of meetings with people on the topic to try and learn about how it's being expressed in Indigenous communities. And so, I learned that the phrase food sovereignty was first introduced to the World Food Summit in the 1990s, I believe, but I think it was developed sooner than that. Priscilla and Tabitha might know more, like the scholars probably could track it back to its original conception, but I learned about it in the 1990s when it was introduced into the World Food Summit. And the definition that they use for food sovereignty there is different from the way I'm going to share my interpretation based on literally thousands of people coming to meetings and entrusting me with the different stories and the different very high context, cultural context and communication pattern that Indigenous people practice through an oral tradition, storytelling tradition. So different from a Eurocentric kind of need to define everything, which often limits what it really means. And it's the English language, so keep in mind that it's limited in its ability to accurately translate all of the high context of Indigenous languages, which there's 11 major Indigenous languages across so-called Canada, and with that, a myriad of cultures and dialects and language groups that you could never reflect in one phrase. So keep that in mind when I share with you what I'm sharing with you. So it's really a description and a translation of what I've heard. And it's from four main reoccurring themes or principles that I've pulled out and the way I've translated it with the help of amazing Indigenous women who helped me organize the very first Indigenous Food Sovereignty Conference in so-called BC at the Anaucan Center in Penticton Indian Reserve back in 2006, where Jeanette Armstrong was executive director and founder at the time, and now she's a Canada Research Chair at UBC Okanagan. But Jeanette Armstrong, Janice Dick-Billy, a doctor, Janice Dick-Billy from my home territory, Suzanne Johnson, which is known in the public health realm, another Okanagan woman, and then Kathleen Neen, one of Canada's leading founding members of the food security movement, helped me to look at the framework. How are we going to frame Indigenous food sovereignty in this conference we organized? And from that conference came a report that I still refer to this day. But I guess that was the beginning of understanding and having the kind of the guidance and direction, advice of those women to help me translate this. So I'm just giving you the background so you know it's where it's come from. But so the first principle, the first of four, is the sacredness, the sacred gift of food, and which is really about recognizing that our sovereignty as Indigenous peoples ultimately comes from our relationship to Creator, who gave us our original instructions to hunt, to fish, to farm, to gather, to be on the land and be in relationship with all of the people, the plants, the animals, the water, the fungus, all of the beings that give themselves to us as food. And then the sacred responsibility, so more a responsibility than a right, to maintain those relationship trusts that were given to us. So the sacred trusts of land, which includes the water, the sacred trusts of culture, spirituality, and our present and future generations, our ancestry. The second principle is the participatory nature of Indigenous food sovereignty. So we cannot achieve food sovereignty without participating in day-to-day activities that involve hunting, fishing, farming, gathering, preparing, sharing, trading, creating our subsisting economy. A corporation isn't going to give us our food sovereignty, and neither is a government. It's really about our participation in it. The third principle is the principle of self-determination. So self-determination, the way I understand it from an Indigenous view, is I think, often different from the way nation states would interpret it. We've got the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was, you know, I recognize and honor the work of many Indigenous scholars who put work into that. But it's framed in a conversation with the nation state. And so self-determination in my language and my culture is translated at individual, family, and community levels, but it starts with ourselves. So Kanukhinstut means take care of yourself. And only then can you Kosalten Owls, and only then can you contribute to your tribe, to the health and well-being of the collective. So self-determination is really starting with ourselves, as responding to our own needs for food, and then from there it spans out to even the nation state, where expressed at multiple scales. And then the fourth principle is the decolonizing policy. So we recognize that Indigenous food sovereignty is ultimately grounded in practice on the ground by us participating, us living the reality, but it's being impacted by colonial policy. So we do need to interface with the nation state in that way, in a decolonizing land and food systems and water policy. So that's, I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Dawn. And I really liked the point that you made about being Indigenous food sovereignty being descriptive and not prescriptive when we're trying to like define concepts like this. Priscilla, is there anything that you would like to add to that definition of what Indigenous food sovereignty means?
Yeah, I don't need to add only in as far as obviously the foodstuffs, the things we rely on locally do have different bases depending on, you know, where we come from. So in that respect, you know, the issues that Dawn's describing, there's a parallel to how this topic is approached within community. And when the concept really hit the international scene was in a big way by Indigenous peoples from Guatemala, where they developed the Declaration of Atitlan, which to me is a brilliant topic that describes much of what Dawn just said through a global lens. And then later, Nayalini out of Mali in Africa. And these are documents that were written on the ground, from the ground up. And in part because while the UN was having meetings on sustainability, Indigenous people attended these meetings in rather small groups because nobody could afford to go there. And it certainly wasn't at the one in 1992 in Brazil, but colleagues were. And they really reported back on what Indigenous peoples, who represent somewhere in the percentage of 4% of the global population, they were talking about a whole new boogeyman kind of concept. And that was this whole area of intellectual property rights. And what they discovered through their participation at the UN Summit on Sustainability, through the Convention on Biological Diversity, which I did take part in that process through, in part, the Canadian government, but as an Indigenous representative. And there we learned that what was happening with the concept of intellectual property rights was that our knowledge was being patented and secured by Western science interests. And this really threw a scare, I might say, into the international Indigenous communities. And of course, you know, the UN declaration in part reflects that. But I think that these declarations that were built in Nayalini and Atitlan, Guatemala, really crystallized what you know, the importance of Indigenous knowledge, the fact that so many species, we've lost millions of species to date and varieties, it's just numbing. And that's the thing that I impress on my students is that, you know, this is our collective heritage, but in large part, it's been Indigenous developed. And so they need to recognize that, but they also have a role to address the disappearing biodiversity, because with the loss of biodiversity is a loss of cultural diversity. So we don't want to live within monopolies, but and we need to recognize the role of some forms of science in creating monopolies for power and control. So it's these huge concepts of power and control that really scared. I mean, it really made us wake up quickly. And so from that time, I've seen quite a consciousness arisen because of the activities of Indigenous peoples, networking, linking, fighting our way to the FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization, where we recognize there's also some pretty good work being done there. But it's so essential that our voices are there. So that's the only bit that I would add to Dawn's really eloquent summary of what embodies, you know, this concept of Indigenous food sovereignty and how it differs in some respect. But then again, the global picture of we really need to pay attention to the loss of biodiversity, because in part, that's what COVID is a symptom of. Oh, and just one last thing. I'm very fortunate to be a board member of both Seed Save Canada, which is an international organization which does really remarkable things. It's not Indigenous, but they really help to secure funding for so-called developing regions and some in Canada and the US, and also the other board that I participate on in the US, it's US based, but again, we have projects all over the world that focus on seed saving and support to small farmers and women's cooperatives is the Cultural Conservancy, which does amazing work both on the land and globally, like it has a reach of global proportion.
Thanks, Priscilla, giving again that international history and perspective to the concept as well. That's really interesting. There's lots there I actually didn't know. Let's move on maybe then to the next question, which is digging a little bit deeper into each of your work and the work that you're doing on the ground, as well as maybe in an academic setting on Indigenous food sovereignty and realizing this concept on the ground. And maybe we'll start, sorry, Tabitha, and Asfia, since we didn't get a chance at the last question, maybe we'll start with Asfia this time. Tell us a little bit more about the work that you mentioned before that you've been doing with OPCN.
Okay, how much time do I have? I'm going to show you some pictures. I think that's the most exciting part of my work. I always try to share the happy faces and things that we do. So just bear with me for a few seconds. And there you go. Okay. And then going back to Zoom. Can you see something? Hello?
Yeah, it looks good. We can see it.
Okay, now I am in the same situation as Dawn. I don't know how to. Okay, is it bigger now? Yes. So this is the building, Idintumitswin program in Opiponapin Cree Nation. Building is the place where whenever we go out with the youth and the elders and harvest food from the land, we bring it back here. And then we do have some traditional teaching here on how to process the food. We have a smokehouse beside it, and there are freezers inside. So we store the food, and once a week, we share the food with the community elders and diabetes patients and single mothers, and prioritizing those who are unable to go out in the land and harvest food from the land. So again, as I was saying, that my work is collective. So these are some beautiful people from the community, our elders, late Elder Vivian Moose, late Elder Annie Spence. We have late Elder Louis Dumas, Elder Josephine, Hilda Dysart, Elder Hilda Dysart, our chief. So it's a beautiful group of people there supporting this program. So it's a collaborative initiative within the community. We have the school and the health complex and the band office. Everybody is coming together to make this program successful. And here's a picture of this huge jackfish that they caught over the winter. These are some other activity pictures. We have lots of fun during the winter, other than the Idin Tumitsuin program that supports the seasonal harvesting activities. They have two other youth camping that's ongoing within the community during summer. One is called Kiwi Kapawitan, the other one is called Wasasi. So these pictures are from there. And then the next one is, this happy face lady is Barb Spence, an amazing health worker, has been working with the elders closely, and a great food champion. She has her own garden. And beside there, you know, we have Elder Hilda Dysart, who's also an advisor to Northern Manitoba Food Culture and Community Collaborative. And here on this side, you see Elder Helen Ross is training some of our children by the smokehouse here. Next picture, we have Jennifer Linklater is an ADI worker and amazing knowledge on different kinds of traditional food and medicines. And so she is regularly working with the diabetes patient and trying to monitor the impact of consuming white fish. And she has been reporting us that it's been actually helping people to stay healthy. And then, as I was saying, that we do some knowledge archiving. So we have been publishing some wild food recipe calendars from the community and distributing in them and we in the school and with different organizations throughout Manitoba. So this is this one, some of the calendars that we published. And this year we published something different. It's the seasonal harvesting and equipment calendar. So again, this is another educational calendar that we have. Yeah, I guess, and then this picture I wanted to just show as part of the impact of hydro. This is on the picture on the right, you can see that it's right after the flooding. And the picture on the left, you see the sandy beaches. So the water level was, I think, 8 to 10 feet higher than usual. And it actually destroyed all the traditional food, land-based food, like from berries to medicinal patches. And this damage is continuing because Manitoba Hydro has the control of water fluctuation. So it's smothering the whitefish eggs and drowning the mossberry patches. And so it's been challenging and difficult for people to try to collect medicine and harvest food going further than they should. Which requires more financial help. So these are some of the challenges that they face on an everyday basis while doing the activities. Yeah, I guess that's where I'm gonna stop. And that's just a little bit of work that people are doing. I really wish some of the members of Opiponapian Cree Nation that have joined us today, they'd have bad internet throughout the week. So we tried, Hannah and I tried to invite some of them, but they are the real heroes. I'm just somebody who's trying to humbly speak on their behalf, and I hope I do justice to their work. So, yeah.
Thanks, Asvia, and thanks for showing those pictures too. They're really helpful for like picturing what's going on and what your work looks like. Next, maybe we'll go to Dawn, Tabitha, I guess, because you didn't speak. Would you rather go Dawn first? Okay, sure. Dawn, could you tell us a little bit more in depth about the work that you're doing?
If Tabitha, because we haven't heard from her yet, but I'll try to keep it brief so that we leave enough time for Tabitha. So I'll just speak to the COVID because we have until, what do we have, another 25 minutes? Is that what we're looking at? Yeah, okay. So I'll just speak to the COVID. I mean, I mentioned the Indigenous Food and Freedom School and the toolkit we're developing. And I mentioned having to push back our timeline a bit on the development of that toolkit because COVID happened and we had to kind of adapt, I guess is the word, or build resiliency to be in stress and uncertainty, which we have as Indigenous peoples always experienced. So really COVID in some people, some people say, oh, it's so nice that the world slowed down because prior to COVID, it was busy. And we, as Indigenous people, are busy responding to so many injustices, both social and environmental. And so COVID was a way to shut the economy down that's really causing the damage that is at the core root cause of so much disease on the planet, and it's a threat to our health. It's a very real public health threat. But what we heard people in our network say about COVID was, you know, the fact that we are here means our ancestors survived the last smallpox epidemic, and that so we've inherited some memories of what it means to be resilient, what it means to overcome a pandemic. But we just need to realize that it's kind of like decolonizing. It's peeling off all the layers and healing all those layers of trauma that have been imposed upon us through colonization, and realizing how we've been conditioned by that and how we respond, how it's weakened us. But I think now is an opportunity. COVID has given an opportunity to, yes, be very real, take the public health concern and threat very seriously, like our ancestors did. And people have been telling stories about, you know, how people just knew to isolate during the epidemic and they'd go off into the bush for 3 weeks, or they'd use traditional medicines, and all this knowledge was coming out. And it also gave us an opportunity because of the economic fallout of COVID, but not just COVID, it's the climate crisis. I think COVID has kind of taken away from the fact that the climate crisis is actually impacting maybe more livelihoods, economic well-being than COVID. But because COVID, we saw the response quickly, it shut down the economy very quickly, where the climate crisis is happening over a number of years. And I don't think we've even seen the beginning of it really in some places. I mean, I know it's different. That's the problem with the pan-Canadian approach, is it's very imperialistic and it's not place-based the way I heard Priscilla open up her talk around how the realities are so different and there's parallels. But so the COVID has given us an opportunity to mobilize our knowledge and networks online, of course, because we haven't been able to gather, to really consolidate our knowledge and our networks and use modern day tools that our ancestors didn't have for communicating when there was a pandemic. And a lot of it is through spiritual work too. Like, it's, I think, coming to realize and decolonize the ways that our work spans across time and distance, because it's our concept of time and humanity is different from mainstream society. So we've actually not lost our ancestral ways of knowing. And that is often spiritual and it's being affirmed even by Western science, like things like meditation and distant healing and ceremony, and all of that's been very, like, I think, more realized. And so we are part of a global network of mutual aid and solidarity with people of color and poor working class white people, and who are mobilizing to develop financial, technical, and legal tools to move away from the capitalist structures and change the economy, a new economy. And so we're cross-fertilizing that work with a subsistence economy of giving, sharing, and trading. And we're developing tools that will be in our Food and Freedom School toolkit to that effect. I'm on the board of directors for the Mutual Aid Network based out of Madison, Wisconsin, but it's really a global network with Maori and a lot of people from the US, many the African Americans who developed the concept of Freedom School back in the 1960s. I'm also on the board of directors for the CCEC Credit Union, a financial institution that's largely, it's a co-op made up of co-op members, and probably one of the last remaining legitimately co-op or community run co-ops, because the financial system is kind of pushing more the big financial banks, the corporate controlled banks and such. So we're kind of on the learning edge of, you know, this new economy and what is that going to look like for Indigenous peoples. So that's kind of part of the economic fallout of COVID. It's kind of given us some time to go deeper into and study what that's going to look like. So I'll end with that for now.
Thanks, Dawn. That sounds like a really interesting project, the Mutual Aid Network. So if you have a link for that or information to share, then I think that the audience would be really interested in learning more about that. Tabitha, you indicated that you had some thoughts to share on COVID and the situation right now.
Yeah, so COVID has been a very interesting time for food, and in many ways it's positioned food to have a much more central role in people's lives. And so we see a lot of interesting responses to that. Mostly at the moment, I'm struck at the fact that, well, first, actually, I want to talk about food security, because, I mean, there's a lot of that in the news right now, or food insecurity. There's a lot of that in the news right now. And I think it's important to sort of distinguish food security from Indigenous food sovereignty, because we are talking about two different things. And, you know, Dawn and Priscilla talked about sort of like this conceptual framework from which Indigenous food sovereignty works, in which, you know, it is decolonizing and it is localized and it is relational. And that relational aspect, I think, is critical for understanding some of the big differences between food security and Indigenous food sovereignty. So you could technically have food security in jail, but it does not mean you have a good relationship with food. And I use that as an example because we know that our people are also overrepresented in the prison system. So ultimately, you can't really, like, the social and environmental implications of food are so intertwined for Indigenous peoples that in order to be doing the work of Indigenous food sovereignty, we have to be doing sort of all the work of Indigenous peoples' humanity, and well-being and livelihoods. And so there have been a lot of responses during COVID with regards to alleviating the hunger. And that's critical. I will never deny that food security doesn't play a critical role in that. But for Indigenous peoples, that's a concept that doesn't resonate for us, because food security is just too short term of a solution. It's too short term of a solution, but most importantly, it makes no attempts to examine the inherent power that is found within our food systems, within a market-based, within a global food system. There's so much power, and we don't think about that power as average consumers, but it's critical to understand that there's power in food. And historically, our communities were starved and experimented on, so we know that food is powerful. And we know with the loss of our lands to hydro, what that has meant for our ancestry, what that has meant for our families, what that has meant for the missing knowledges. All of those pieces, we have a sense that they're there. So COVID has brought a lot more attention to food, but certainly I think what we'd like to see is that attention brought to understanding Indigenous food sovereignty and supporting Indigenous food sovereignty initiatives. So the government, you know, $100,000 was given to, $100 million was given to food banks in Canada. And Dawn and Priscilla were on a group that brought a whole bunch of us together, including the National Indigenous Diabetes Association and Alyssa Levi. And we all came together to sort of try and push back against this lump sum going to food banks. And that's largely because our people don't have access to food banks on reserve, but also because what we need to feed ourselves is for us to feed ourselves. That's the critical piece. So self-determination is so important for our health and well-being. And it's just as important in the resurgence of culture that we're seeing around Indigenous food sovereignty. So COVID has brought a lot of attention to food, but it hasn't brought a lot of attention to our relationship with food. And yet that's on display, because at the same time that we're hearing stories of food insecurity, we're hearing stories of fishermen throwing their fish back into the water. We're hearing stories of farmers dumping all their potatoes in the landfill. We're hearing stories of baby animals being culled before they could even be born into, you know, an opportunity, which I suppose is better than factory farms. I mean, certainly, but nonetheless, it speaks to the inequities and how broken our food system is, that we have the highest number, we're seeing higher than ever levels of food insecurity, of experiences of hunger. We're also wasting food at alarming rates. What does that say about the systems that we're part of? That, to me, is deeply problematic. And that's why we have to start looking at our own relationships to the food systems. Now, my own Cree teachings carry responsibility. My name, Sipikobanisis, tells me my instructions. I am given the instructions in my name of how to enact my responsibility for my family and for the deal that my family made with creation when I came to be. And so when we become active participants in our food system, like Dawn spoke to earlier, when we become active participants in our food systems, we have to take a relational and responsible view. Not only do we have the responsibility to carry out these duties, these connections to the land, to the plants, to the animals, to all beings. But we do have a responsibility to do the work of dismantling racism in our food system. At the same time, we have to do the work of ridding ourselves of the structural and systemic policies that prevent us from being able to access the land, that prevent us from being able to share food, that prevent us from doing all of the things that we know keeps us well. We know it keeps us well, and the elders have been saying this for a really long time. And so what COVID has brought, and what I see as an opportunity, is for us to explore what is our relationship to food and the land, and how do we live in a manner that demonstrates our responsibility and our gratitude for the gifts that land has given us, for the gifts that creation has given us in terms of life. And so there's lots of work to be done. And we're at an incredible point in time. And I don't want to take up more time on this, but to say that some of the things that I'm working on really quickly, and I want to shout out to Nicole Davies, who reached me to connect with some Indigenous seed savers, and we're trying to grow out a whole bunch of varieties. So that's another way that we need to examine our relationship to the food system, because what we're also seeing is people hoarding food, and we're also seeing, and this breaks my heart, is we're seeing people hoarding seeds. Please, 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 if those seeds are going to end up in the basement, please don't buy them. Those seeds are part of creation. They're part of the responsibility that we give in our food systems. And so hoarding is another another experience that has emerged during the pandemic. That's not a relational worldview. There's no value in hoarding. And if we want to have greater trust in our food systems, then we have to be more active in our food systems. We have to be more active in participating in them and more active in dismantling all of the pieces that do not work. So a lot of that, so some of the things I'm doing during COVID are seed saving, working on some education pieces, in particular around all of the funds that have been given to food banks, and the ways that Indigenous people will receive money or communities may receive money is to try and create a more holistic approach. I'm also working on thinking about an Indigenous evaluation approach, because when Indigenous organizations are given money during the pandemic, who's valuing what we do with that money? Who's ascribing the terms of whether or not we were successful with those funds? So that's another piece. And then largely continuing to work on ridding us of the Safe Food for Canadians Act, which interferes with our ability to share food. And in Cree culture, that is one of the fundamental values of our culture. So just a few thoughts.
Wow, amazing, really amazing words, Tabitha. And thank you for all of those insights into the current situation with COVID and just all the different ways that it's impacting us and all the ways that we should be responding. Priscilla, do you have any thoughts that you would want to add on, I guess, on your work and maybe connecting that to COVID or not? I'll give the floor to you for a few minutes.
Yes, in my teaching, which I'm in the midst of right now, I use my responsibility to understand the struggles of justice for migrant workers, a really important angle or issue in Canada. For migrant workers produce a lot of the fruits and vegetables that appear on the public's plate. They are not given citizenship rights of any sort, including housing, visits with family, transportation, healthcare. Often when they're injured, they're sent back to their country of origin. And so this is another angle of food justice that I teach about, that we really need to address to the Canadian government, because they are responsible for allowing workers to come in with no human rights. And so the COVID issue, even some of the Jamaican workers have been forced to sign statements that they will not hold their employers responsible should they develop COVID. And we know the horrific situation with Cargill Foods in Alberta, where, you know, people have died. And still, Cargill puts on a beautiful face. So I think Canadians generally, anyone listening to this, need to understand that food justice is an issue. And it's certainly related to the human rights that we as Indigenous people pursue in our own community. So that's all I'll say.
Thanks, Priscilla. And yeah, I think that's a good point. And it kind of speaks to what Dawn was talking about a little while earlier about solidarity in between like anti-racism movements and other types of movements, as well as Indigenous peoples and Indigenous food sovereignties, because in many ways those fights are related. We're getting close to the end of our time together here, but it looks like we've had a couple of questions that I'm just working on bringing up. One of our first questions here was someone from the audience who was wondering, is there a place for Indigenous nation-driven Western-style farming in Indigenous food sovereignty? Do any of the panelists have thoughts on that? Dawn, yeah, go ahead.
On this one, because right now in my home territory, in Shikwatmakuluk, we're witnessing
huge corporations coming in and grabbing the last bits of agricultural land. And we have some of the prime agricultural soil here that's been clean and kept clean. And it's literally been classified as superior to anywhere else in North America because of that. And, you know, the placement, like the orientation of the land and the richness of the soil. And but what we're really wanting to do is to show a model of regenerative farming that's been indigenized. So we've got a nature-based conservation planner who's willing to decolonize their planning framework, because the governments and the system does not have a planning framework, an adequate planning framework, to be able to address the complexity of Indigenous restoring and protecting and maintaining the last remaining fragments of Indigenous land and food systems. And so, yes, we know that our nations have adopted agriculture as a way to supplement our traditional diets, because we don't have access to our traditional foods like we used to. We can't even feed all of our own people on our traditional foods, let alone the way the governments are opening up the hunting and fishing to sports and recreation people that are doing it for trophy rather than for food. And here in BC, the government declared hunting essential service during COVID. So they opened up hunting at a time of year where it shouldn't be done at all, by even like Indigenous people won't hunt at this time of year. And so the government's opened it up, and we're hearing people with gunshots. Like, there's hunters out in the bush at times of year when they shouldn't be. Anyways, I'm kind of going off track, but it's related because we're seeing the impacts that Western agriculture is having on our hunting corridors, and the corridors where our elk and our deer would normally get to the river to drink water can no longer do that because of the fencing. That's agriculture, you know, they fence it so that the animals don't get in to eat their food. But we're showing a model of farming, of Indigenous permaculture, a way to plant gardens in a way that conserves those heritage seeds that I know Priscilla is doing work on seeds, and I heard Tabitha mention it. We need to be growing out these heritage seeds that Indigenous peoples have adapted and given the world, really. The heritage of humanity really is what it is. And we need to not just grow food for us, we need to grow food for elk and wild salmon and all of the species that we're losing at unprecedented rates. And so the species actually need us to do farming, but they need us to do it in a not the Western model. We need to grow food for the animals, not just for ourselves. So we can do that without fencing. And there's lots of knowledge, but really it's Indigenous people that need to be accredited for that and seen as actually playing a significant role in creating a new model of farming. I know that regenerative farming and agroecology are the two bodies of knowledge being generated right now in research and policy. But the problem is that they're still perpetuating a framework that doesn't look at social justice and that doesn't look at the broader scope and scale of Indigenous land and food systems and the connection between the health of farming and the health of the neighboring Indigenous ecosystems. So I'll leave it at that, but I just, because we're fighting these big campaigns, these big corporations, and it's women on the front lines, and really the core issue is water, because they're extracting a lot of water, releasing a lot of carbon into the soil with the way they're plowing up soil, and there are other methods, we know that. So I can't not talk about it and not get excited, but anyways, thank you.
Do any of the other panelists have thoughts to add on that, or we'll move to another question? Okay, great. I think we have time. We're running a little bit over time here, but maybe we have time for one more audience question, and then we'll wrap it up. So I'm looking here. I wonder if any of the panelists have thoughts. There's a question here that's asking, what does Indigenous food sovereignty look like in urban areas? And I guess given that the context is different and there's lots of Indigenous people who do live in the city, what does Indigenous food sovereignty look like there? Do any of the panelists have any thoughts on that? I'll give you maybe a few moments to think about it. Yeah, Priscilla, go ahead. And remember to...
I think it's chapter 10 in our new book. Can you hear me? No? Yeah, okay. And Rachel Stringer Engler and Lise Kosick-Curry and two others talk about how in the food desert area, in the urban reality of people who've migrated from, like come from northern and rural communities in search of better housing and employment, et cetera. The core area of Saskatoon is an area where food deserts exist. It's also a place where some of our allies through the Child Hunger Education Program have helped, and I've been part of this urban guerrilla, urban gardening movement to establish over 60 urban gardens, community gardens. And so, yes, there is an opportunity that we know sometimes cultures, in order to survive, must diversify. So it's not simply a cultural thing of, you know, getting only our traditional foods, but it's an issue of survival in food deserts. So in the one city ward where the majority of our people are Indigenous, there is absolutely no grocery stores. So all of the big food conglomerates choose to go to the burbs because it's more lucrative for them. And so what we have is an overabundance of fast food places, and it's really taken a human toll on our communities. There's, 248% higher, or it could even be 300% higher infant mortality rate among Indigenous babies in this region. So food is desperation. It's a desperate situation. And so, yes, we have had to learn to adapt to that. And it is possible with some of our allies. It's not the perfect picture of cultural purity, but like I said, you know, when you've got children who are hungry that go to school without, you know, three square meals a day, when you have children, babies dying at rates that are even higher than so-called third world countries, we have a problem. And so I've been part of that movement on the ground in the urban, and it's been fairly successful. And I know it's been criticized as something that's just cool now. People do it because it's cool. Everybody's putting up little, you know, raised gardens and that. And one of the things that I require my students to do is to take a handful of seeds and plant them at the beginning of class in the first week and show that those seeds, how they've grown at the end of class. So it's not perfect, but it's to get, you know, citizens who haven't maybe appreciated that our food doesn't come wrapped under plastic. It doesn't grow like that. That it's, you know, animals need to be killed if we're going to eat meat. But there's also a cultural way to do that as well. So it's complex. It's a complex issue in a world with far too much hunger. At the same time, we still explain that it is the food, small food farmers that produce the world's the most of the world's foods, and that the agricultural chain, which represents lots of money and resources and wealth, is the one that uses up the most land and are the least productive. And that's courtesy the fabulous work of the Etc. Group, Etc., ETC. Listeners can Google that and learn about the amazing work of Etc.
Thanks, Priscilla. And I think I'm a little bit familiar with the work by Rachel Engler Stringer that you mentioned, and how she talks about those like networks of sharing that exist between Indigenous people living in this city that receive food from their relatives that are living outside. And it's very interesting. So as Priscilla mentioned, check out her book, because Rachel has a chapter in that one. I think we're going to wrap up here. We're already 5 minutes over time, unfortunately. So I just like to say thank you to all of our panelists so much for joining us here today. And we could obviously talk for much, much longer. There's so much to cover, and it's hard to do even just like a little bit in an hour and a half. But I think that we touched on some really interesting things here, especially about food sovereignty in the time of COVID. So thanks so much to all our panelists, Dawn Morrison, Tabitha Martins, Priscilla Setti, and Asfia Kamal, for sharing their thoughts here today. I'll just mention a few things that our project, the COVID Indigenous Project and Winiskatan, would like to mention that we're working on. We do have an ongoing call out for people living in Indigenous communities to submit stories, photos, or videos of what COVID looks like in their communities and how their communities are responding from places of strength and resilience. So you can submit those photos and stories through our website, and we'll drop the link in the chat. We also have more information about the work that our project is doing that's about sharing stories, again, about COVID through interviews. We have some videos with a Cree-speaking raven, Gaga Gyu, that's about sharing information about COVID and social distancing in a more culturally appropriate way, and also in a humorous way. Kaka Gyu has some videos coming out with elders, as well as with MLA Nikki Ashton pretty soon. So you can check those out on our website and through our Facebook page. As well as this webinar will be available, we recorded it here today, and so this will be available on our Facebook page, as well as on our website, if there's anything that you want to go back and watch it again and relive this, or if you want to share it with anyone else, then it'll be available there, as well as our past webinars. Trying to think if there's anything else that I should mention. Our next webinar will be happening in 2 weeks, and that one is going to be on some of the impacts of the hydro industry, especially the continuing work on hydro in the context of COVID and that intersection with and impacts on Indigenous communities there. And so probably many of you might have seen some of the conflict that erupted last week here in Manitoba around the Hydro Kiosk project and the blockade that was set up by Tataskwayak Nation, as well as a few other nations up in northern Manitoba. We're going to hopefully be able to get some of the people who are involved with that on the panel, as well as looking at people who are experiencing similar conflicts across Canada, potentially maybe even international. We're working on getting those contacts set up. So stay tuned to our Facebook page and to our website. There'll be more information about that. As you can see, lots of the panelists were dropping links to the work that they were talking about in the chat here today. We'll be working on compiling some of those resources, and we'll be sharing those again in the Facebook event for this webinar, on our own Facebook page, and maybe on our website as well. So you can watch for those resources as well. And I'll just maybe give the last word to our panelists. If there's anything else that any of you would like to mention that you have coming up or that you're working on that you would like people to know about, just indicate that now. Does anyone have anything that they want to share? Yeah, Dawn.
to quickly say, it was to the last question, and I won't go on about it, but what does decolonizing the food system look like in urban areas? Our working group on Indigenous food sovereignty has recently been successful in working with the Vancouver Parks Board and the City of Vancouver to have them accept our vision to restore Indigenous food lands in Strathcona Park. It's a very historical park where Indigenous and people of color have been displaced, and there's a lot of history. And so that's, I think, a really important way to achieve food sovereignty in urban areas is to access to land. And sometimes that means influencing governments and people and the way that they do planning in cities and urban areas, because it really, in that space, the working group is just an intermediary to facilitate and hold the vision, but really it's Coast Salish, it's Indigenous land. So what that's gonna look like by Coast Salish protocols is still to be determined. But anyways, I just wanted to add that, because one of the necessary underlying issues that need to be addressed for food sovereignty is land and water infrastructure. And so there are models. So stay tuned for more how that's going to shape up, but it's been approved and accepted into their capital planning for 2022 to the 26th. So it's a 4-year capital planning project where you'll see changes happening in that park.
Is there a link or a website, Dawn, that people could receive updates on that project?
Well, I can share our indigenousfoodsystems.org when we will be writing blogs about it, but it's still, you know, in process, and it's we are convening a council of matriarchs to help us with the governance of that, the Coast Salish matriarchs. And so we will write blogs through that, and we'll share that on the indigenousfoodsystems.org website.
Okay, amazing. Yeah, that sounds awesome. Does anyone else have anything that they want to quickly share? Nope. Okay, if not, again, check out all the links to all of our panelists' amazing ongoing work that's going to be continuing into the coming months as we hopefully recover from COVID and move on and continue this work. Thank you so much to all our audience for joining us today. Thank you again to all of our panelists, and stay well out there. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.